Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ross Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Ross?
Very well, Justin. How are you? I'm enjoying the sunshine, at least.
Yeah, it's bright, you know, in the real world, but in the financial world, it's still gloomy. You know, it's still wintry and really dark and gloomy clouds. Let's talk about inflation. There's all different kinds of measures of inflation, and I've heard greedflation, shrinkflation, and in fact, I think it was the boss of Sainsbury's came out today and said, we're not profiteering from higher prices. But why don't you look at their profit? They did make $630 million, so they did make a profit. Prices are higher, so they are sort of profiteering from higher prices. I mean, it's gone down, yes, but they're not like making a loss, are they? So they are making a profit. But there's people saying the greedflation, and your wife spotted shrinkflation, which is another thing.
That's a shocker. I'm not going to name the firm or the brand, but it was a box of breakfast cereals for the teenagers, and last week it was 600 grams box. This week it's a 500 gram box for the same price. That's a 20% price hike in effect, but it's just doing it a different way because the actual price that paid for the box was £3.50, and it is the same. But yeah, you're getting 20% less for your money. So it's inflation in another sneaky way. I have a bit of sympathy with the Sainsbury's guy. I mean, he's working to a 3-4% operating margin.
Yeah,
it's not that fat, right? I mean, and he's having to deal with the major food groups, some of whom, like Unilever and Nestle, are making 18-20% operating margins. Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, if anybody is, again, doing a good job of, you know, protecting themselves from the ravages of inflation, it's the big brands, but that's the power of the brands.
Yeah.
I think greedflation is a really tricky one because I think it's a matter of alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody forces you to buy an Aston Martin, right? You can trade down to a Lada if you really want and still get around.
Mm-hmm.
But I think food and fuel and energy are a bit different because we all have to eat. We all have to keep the house warm, keep the lights on, keep the hot water running.
Yeah.
So then that's why you have regulators. And then it's a matter of what alternatives are available. And I guess in theory, a Sainsbury's customer can go to a different supermarket and shop around, or you'd not buy brands and buy own brands. There are things that you can do, but that can only go so far. And clearly with, you know, household heating, that there's a little bit you can do in terms of chopping and changing, but that's got a little bit hard with the energy price caps now.
Mm.
So I think the greedflation thing is a matter of what alternative is available. And then you're getting into the ethics and morality of it. Now, from a shareholder's point of view, you might believe in shareholder primacy as an investment company. Actually, it's the company's job to get the best possible returns for the owners of the business,
mm-hmm.
the investor. End of. And you might just view it as dollars and cents, nickels and dimes. Now, clearly, with the rise of ESG investing, there's a whole new breed of investor, and certainly younger investors are a lot more, you could say, aware of the bigger picture of a stakeholder society. And I think that it certainly is beholden to a board and a chief executive. Yes, of course, try and do your best to create shareholder value, but not do it in such a cack-handed, ham-fisted, cloth-eared fashion that you bring the wrath of the public or grandstanding politicians or the regulator upon you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's the case, you can lose your reputation, you can be fined, you can even use your loss of license to operate. So there is clearly a sensible balancing act between profit and cash flow maximization and the knock-on effects of that, because there's no point making loads of money now if you're going to under-invest in the business for the next 2 years and then damage it in the long run, or in bring the regulator onto your, or yourself onto the regulator's radar, and they introduce something that really seriously crimps your business model. So there is a balancing act to be made there. And it was interesting looking at SSE's report this week, and they made an awful lot of money, you know, the former Scottish and Southern Energy business, although there was then a derivatives paper loss, which meant the company actually made a loss. But the first two or three pages of the statement were all about renewable energy, how much we're investing, all the good that we're doing, all the net zero that we're doing, and the stuff about profits and dividends was way down the bottom. Yeah. So I think companies are very, very aware of how this looks, and I think SSE probably got the balance about right, because they're increasing their capex budget, they're cutting their dividend, they're emphasising renewable energy and investment for the long run. And I think, you know, nobody really held them up to this greedflation thing at all, even though underlying they probably made a couple of billion quid.
Yeah.
So I think it's a matter of how companies present it. And I think Sainsbury's actually are pretty price competitive, and they address a certain demographic. I think it's hard to accuse a company of greedflation when they're making 3-4% operating margins. Personally,
yeah, you know, I think it's greed. You're right. It's about discretionary and non-discretionary. Isn't it? When people have
correct.
To buy
it's
stuff,
the, you know, correct. And, that's the issue.
And I suppose the thing is, it's not. You know, people are now sort of cutting their costs, or tightening their belts and all that. And you do get the supermarkets saying we are cutting costs, and but they, you know, they mean, I know it's the margins are small, but that's what supermarkets do. They stack them high, sell them cheap, and you know that's
correct.
But when you get, you know, you see, you know, 690 million a profit, and you think, well, you're still making decent profit. You're not losing money. But
I think one of the supermarkets are probably doing is cutting out the loss leaders that they used to use to attract people in.
Yeah.
So a lot of the fresh meat and fish counters have gone, and milk. I know it's gone up a lot in the last year, but it's only really gone back to where it was 5 or 6 years ago, according to some retail analysts. So, you know, I used to be able to walk into my Sainsbury's local and get 4 pints of milk for a quid. Now it's about £1.60, £1.80. But that's only where it was a few years ago. So in that respect, we've been very lucky. We've gone through an amazing period of very cheap food, fuel. You could even say very cheap labour in many cases. And look at Aldi, what was it, Lidl offering a 13% pay rise this week? All right, it's absolutely brilliant for the staff, but you do wonder whether some of that will trickle down in terms of the end cost. So it's I think we've had an amazing period of very low food, fuel, goods and prices, and I think that now feels like it's reversing because energy prices are higher, unemployment is very low, so labor is getting more of a say in the matter and we're demanding a bigger share of the pie. Globalization is starting to reverse to some degree, so cheap imports are already available. We're looking to protect jobs at home. So some of the big and money is now more expensive. It's no longer, interest rates are no longer zero. They're 4.5% in the UK. So a lot of the things that we've become accustomed to that really helps a lot of people are in reverse right now, and other people are getting a little bit of help instead. So it's a bit of a different world, and maybe that's why, you know, to go back to your original point, stock markets, although they're generally still, I mean, I think Japan's at a 33-year high, America's near its all-time high, the UK's near its all-time high, Germany's just hit a new all-time high, I think. It does feel like it's tough sledding out there at the moment, despite all of those highs. And the progress is hard. I think the S&P just went, I mean, you can look at the chart. I think the S&P just went through a period where it's basically been an incredibly narrow band for about a month of barely moving at all. You know, there certainly haven't been any big sort of 1% plus daily movements. So it's almost as if the market's waiting to see, is inflation going to break out? Are rates going to have to go a lot higher? Is the debt ceiling? It just feels like there's a bit of a phony war going on right now. And nobody's quite sure what's happening. And the US market has made progress this year, but the breadth has been narrow. It's what, 8 stocks have generated 80 or 90% of the returns, or something. It's not a healthy situation.
A lot of that is AI, isn't it? Related. I mean,
look at Nvidia this week.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, if we get the S&P 500, it's pretty much gone from 3,800 bottom of the range to 4,200 top of the range since almost July last year. So it's gone up and down a little bit more than that in some parts, but generally that's the range. But so let's look at the inflation figures, because it came out this week. And, you know, they were expecting 8.3% year-on-year to April, down from 10.1%. It came in at 8.7%. So even though it was above expectations, it was, you know, a nice little drop. Yeah, nice little drop below that. But everyone started saying then, well, hang on a sec, this is not good, because core inflation rose by 6.8%, up from 6.2%. So And that was the worry. And they said that's what banks are looking at. The central bank is looking at core inflation. Explain to people, what is core inflation? What does it mean? And why are people worried? Why are central banks, you know, focusing on that?
So the all inflation readings we get are based upon an index. And the index is constructed of the price of a basket of goods, and it's adjusted every month. And economists and punters like me and you then look at the month-on-month change and the year-on-year change, and that's the prevailing rate of inflation. So inflation at 8.7% still means that prices have gone up 8.7% year-on-year. It just means that the rate of growth is faster than it was in the previous month. So an 8.7 isn't a good number. Let's face it, nobody's happy about that. And the Bank of England's target is 2. Core inflation excludes food, fuel, alcohol, and tobacco.
So what else is there?
Now, you might. Well, that's you know what? That's exactly. Yeah. You're stealing my jokes now,
no,
mate.
Sorry.
But yeah, and in a way, you think, what a stupid thing to do, because they're some of the most important things in people's lives, right? Mm. So why would an economist want to exclude something that's so fundamental to the existence of a lot of. Now, I don't smoke, and a lot of people don't drink, but you know, certainly food and fuel. Right in there. So why would you exclude that? Well, I think it's a strange thing to do because they're fundamental to people's pockets and lives, but they're excluded from this reading because they can be incredibly volatile. Mm-hmm. And so what economists and bankers, central bankers, try to look at is, you know, the core of the inflation figure. And this is why it's frightened people, because it's accelerating.
Yeah.
Whereas the rate of the headline inflation came down because oil, gas prices down, energy prices down, energy price cap coming down, petrol at the pump coming down, and so on. The core number excludes all of that, and it's gone up, and goods and services both accelerated. And this is probably the nightmare scenario for the Bank of England, because it doesn't really fit with an easy narrative of this was nothing to do with us. It's all down to the Russian war in Ukraine and the invasion and energy prices. Actually, this is saying inflation might be coming entrenched, and it's the Bank of England's scenario that they don't want to see of higher wages, higher prices, higher wages, higher prices. And people get accustomed to paying higher prices because they're getting the wages to help them compensate for that. So the Bank of England has made some comments which come across, frankly, as being a bit cloth or tin-eared of, please don't ask for higher wages, ladies and gentlemen, because it's just going to make things worse. Mm-hmm. Now, I know it's probably quite easy for the governor of the Bank of England earning a fair slice. It's a lot less easy to listen to that or go abide by that if, you know, you're working some strange hours on a night shift and your wages aren't keeping pace with your cost of living, right? So we can all thoroughly understand why workers are looking for a pay increase to help them meet the cost of living. But what the Bank of England doesn't want is a 1970s-style wage spiral where people get used to paying higher prices and can, because the wages catch up. So although in nominal terms you probably feel okay, in real terms you probably actually know better off on a post-inflation term. So this has now got central bankers worried, it's got financial markets worried, and the UK 2 and 10-year gilt yields both rose in expectation of the Bank of England maybe not pausing with interest rates at 4.5%. In fact, markets have now priced in 5.5% by the end of the year. So they've basically priced in a quarter point increase at all four meetings for the second half of the year of the Monetary Policy Committee. And that's probably why interest rate sensitive stocks like house builders, life insurers, to a degree the banks, had a big wobble at the end of this week, because they were hoping for actually rates going down, because rates going down means mortgages are cheaper, means more housing demand, good for house builders. You might now, in fact, get the direct opposite, which is why the building stocks, for example, have been so weak this week, and it all goes back to that core inflation number.
Yeah, well, I'm looking now at the government, UK government 10-year bond, and literally, it's, where is it by? Where we are?
It's almost back to Trussonomics levels.
Yeah, 4.3. Now, it peaked out pretty much at 4.4, and literally, so we are literally breathing, you know, a whisker of that. But so there's the cost of goods and services outside food and energy, so anything else.
And alcohol and tobacco,
yeah. Alcohol and tobacco.
So it's things like train tickets, restaurants, cinema, you know, leisure.
Yeah, okay.
Things that, you know, I mean, in a way, you know, things that actually higher interest rates are designed. I mean, the problem with the Bank of England increasing the cost of everybody's mortgage effectively by raising interest rates is that, you know, a lot of the inflation we have seen is in food and people have got to eat. So there's no point making, you know, you can say, well, that's a bit of a crude tool, isn't it? But this is the inflation the Bank of England will be worried about, because once it gets embedded in the system, it's really, really hard to squeeze it out. Now, the Bank of England will say, look, we've acted really quickly. We've just put 12 consecutive interest rate increases through. We've gone from 0.1, whatever it was, to 4.5, double quick. But The last time core inflation was at 6.8% was March 1992. The Bank of England base rate, which is then controlled by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, not the Bank of England, that wasn't made independent until 1998. The base rate was, I think, about 13%. Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, now, if you look at how central banks in the past have really got on top of inflation, they've had the base rate above the rate of inflation for quite a long period of time. That is a positive real interest rate. Right now we have a negative real interest rate, which actually means monetary policy is still very loose.
Yeah.
So the Bank of England is still effectively betting, assuming, believing, arguing that the prevailing rate of inflation will decelerate strongly in the second half of the year. And they might be right, because, again, it's an index, right? So the base effect will start to kick in. The index rose very sharply last year. You will get a base effect. And if oil and gas prices stay low and the Ofgem price cap comes down again and petrol pumps behave themselves, that will all help. Heaven help us if the oil price goes back up for any reason. That will be particularly unpleasant. But so you will get that. But then if you look at the inflation in the 70s, there were two or three waves of it, which were partially driven by wage inflation. And that's when getting the inflation genie back in the bottle proved really, really hard and actually took a big spell of very high and very uncomfortable interest rates. Now, Jeremy Hunt's told Sky News today, he's happy with a recession as the price to crush inflation. Yeah. And I'm actually quite, you know, and that's what it might come down to. Now, recessions are not funny, but we have been through an awful lot of them since 1900 and beyond, and they are part of the natural warp and weft. And frankly, if you keep your job during a recession, it doesn't make any difference to you at all, particularly. But it's those who lose their jobs that it's really tough on. And so this is the balancing act. And I was, you know, politically, you're going to be dead unpopular if there's inflation. I would guess you're going to be even more dead unpopular if there's unemployment going through the roof. So it's a very, very tricky political balancing act and a tricky economic one. But I think in the long run, galloping inflation would do more damage than a recession, a shallowish recession. Yes, I personally would. But it takes a brave politician actually to say, yeah, a recession's a price worth paying, because you know, there will be people lose their jobs. And that's not nice for those individuals involved at all.
Yeah, well, if you look at it, you know, recession is defined by two quarters of negative
That's
GDP,
it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And when you think where we are, we're like 0.1% above that or whatever, you know, it won't be a material difference anyway if you go to minus 0.1, you know. So it isn't a number, a decimal point, isn't it? So it's not like it's going to drop off a cliff and no one's working. There's a depression. So, yeah, maybe we do need that to slow it down. And do you know what? It's previously... And I think that's the problem at the moment. The markets, the main market industry is not doing too badly, but the smaller caps and all that. And
they're getting shredded, aren't they?
Yeah, they're shredded. And so we probably need that official recession announcement, because like we said before, was it in America they announced the recession and they revised the figures? And they said, oh, we were in recession actually back then.
This is it. I mean, the great financial crisis or the recession... on the official numbers started in the end in Q4 2007. They didn't declare it till Q4 2008. So again, you know, you certainly mustn't use GDP forecasts or macro like that as the basis for your investment decisions, because you're just going to be very behind the curve. Whether you're buying a fund or individual stocks, you certainly don't want to go looking at those numbers or projections, I can assure you, because they'll just get you in trouble.
And generally, when an official recession is announced, the markets tend—that's the bottom, pretty much—and it tends to rally after that, because
if that's as bad as it's going to get, things are going to get better. And if things get better, I want to get moving now, right? So that's very much the thought process, absolutely.
Yeah, and basically, quickly on Japan, you've seen they're doing very well there. The stock market is what? Why is that then?
Partly because it's done badly for so long. Okay. And if you think it's still a quarter below its all-time high, which was December 1989, if you look at the chart. Yeah. So they've been through a brutal period. Now, the trouble began with, stop me if you've heard this one before, a cheap debt-fueled property and stock market bubble. So that burst in December 89. So they basically took the Nikkei from 40,000 to 8,000 by the time it had bottomed. But what's changed in Japan in the past few years? Well, the thing that hasn't changed in Japan that's helping its market is the Bank of Japan is still running quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies, which nobody else is now. So there's still lots of money sloshing around the financial system. You're relatively politically stable. I know that Shinzo Abe was assassinated last year, the former prime minister. But his successor, Mr. Kishida, you know, seems pretty set, and he's keeping on with the Abe reform program. Mm-hmm. A lot of Japanese companies are becoming more shareholder friendly. They're unlocking cross holdings. They're talking more about shareholder culture, buybacks, being open to takeovers, private equities getting involved, activists are getting involved. Japan's cheap on an earnings basis, a book value basis. The companies are very heavily cashed up. They've been through their own debt crisis. They've learned from it. They're probably where Japan in the late 1980s is probably where America is now in some ways, in terms of cheap money and debt drunkenness, which is something we probably need to think about from the US equities perspective. So you've got political stability, still supportive monetary policy, cheap stocks, management waking up to shareholder value. And generally, nobody's been talking about it. And strange enough, it's been doing quite well without anybody really realizing. And it's still a quarter below its all-time peak. So that's probably why Japan is. And also, it benefits from oil prices going down because it's a big importer. It probably benefits if China reopens. It's a bit of a global macro play. It's got some top quality exporters. So it does have a lot of things going for it. The one thing that's always probably held you back is, to a degree, the impenetrability to the Western eye of Japanese corporate culture. And that is seems to be slowly changing as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, there we are. Maybe, what's
go east, young man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in fact, saying that, China's not doing very well at the moment, is it?
It's not, which might put a bit of a dampener on a lot of things, actually, because I know NVIDIA blew the doors off with its first quarter results this week, the graphics chip and maker, but analog devices were nowhere near as bullish, and they actually cited a slowdown in automotive and industrial and said that the Chinese recovery in electric vehicles as well wasn't as big as they'd been hoping, which might be one for Tesla shareholders to consider, but again, did put a bit of a dampener on things. So there are so again, I think this is why markets are a bit betwixt and between. There's clearly a lot of expectation and hope out there, but equally, the reality of it might be quite as glossy and shiny as it seems potentially.
Yeah, well, do you know what? If you're feeling too clever, you maybe have a little thought for Cathie Wood. Did you see what she did?
She didn't flog all of. Did you sell all of her Nvidia? Is that right?
Yeah. So literally, she's
when it rains, it pours.
I know. Literally, her fund is poor. Did very well, when it was easy, fast money going around, and all invested her ARK fund, of course, innovation fund, invested in high tech, all these tech stocks, and that were sort of, could say, very highly valued. But one of the holdings, the big holdings of hers, was Nvidia, and she sold it apparently back in October of last year.
Right at the bottom.
It was, amazingly, she's got a knack for this, but she caught the bottom on this. $125 it was then, and literally it just gapped up to $375 in the last. But it's like one of the things she thought was overvalued was Nvidia. And that's been the stand-up performer that she sold at the low. It's like, wow.
And you know what? I look at the valuation, I have trouble justifying. I could have said the same thing then. And it's how it goes, right? But yeah. I think the thing is, with that fund's performance, it's a great lesson. Never mistake a bull market for brains.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous stuff. Cheers, Ross. Speak next week.
Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.